We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
And welcome to In the Know, the Hornets 24/7 podcast. Your knowledgeable hosts are Michael McNamara.
Me and a grizzly bear, I'm betting on me.
And me, Ryan Schwan.
I've been playing some Dungeons & Dragons because I'm really cool like that.
Let's get it started. All Hornets, all the time.
Welcome to the show. The Hornets just completed a 1-2 week, winning the one game that mattered against CP3 and the Clippers, and losing a close one to San Antonio. Michael, the game against our good old buddy CP3, all year long you said you felt sick whenever the Hornets won. How'd you feel?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple where I don't mind the victories. I mean, obviously there was a Dallas game a couple weeks back that it was nice to get a victory. The Lakers game, Hornets almost pulled one out. Though there's a couple games here and there where I definitely don't mind a victory. And at the time, I was happy. But then after watching Jason Smith just get destroyed by the national media, I was really happy the Hornets won that game because I just think what happened to him, especially afterwards, was kind of unfair on a national level.
Yeah. So, I mean, and this is the weirdest part, because I always think Jalen Rose is kind of annoying. But he was the only one who had, he was the only one I saw that said, oh, I don't even think he should be, get any sort of suspension. I think it was just a hard foul on the ball and probably should have been only a flagrant one. Everybody else was, oh, he should get 5 games. It's like, what the hell?
So, okay, if we were to make up a pie chart of reasons why this became a national story. Because, I mean, there's hard fouls on every night. This year, there's 12 to 14 games some nights in the NBA. There's hard fouls in all of them. I mean, Jason Smith got knocked out. He got a concussion in the Detroit game. He got beat up 2 or 3 times in that game, never became a story. If you were to list some or all of the reasons about why this became a national story, what are some of the factors for you?
Blake Griffin and the Clippers. That's it. Honestly, I mean, there are worse fouls all the time, and I completely agree that if you foul someone really hard on a fast break when the person's going up, you deserve to get your ass tossed, and you deserve probably a suspension, because you don't hit them when they're in the air. But Griffin wasn't in the air. He wasn't anywhere near the air. He got hit really hard, and I'm not really upset Jason Smith got tossed out of the game. I don't have a problem with that, because that game had been pretty chippy all along, and if the refs feel they need to get control of it that way, fine. The suspension, I think, is kind of silly, though here's my one theory. I think he might have gotten a two-game suspension so that he wouldn't be there for the next Clippers game to have any retaliation situations coming up.
Right. But, okay, so when you say Blake Griffin was the reason for it, you know, it becoming a national story, are you just talking about the fact that he's a star, superstar, or...
Right, because he's a superstar, that it was, you know, a major superstar being leveled by a nobody. And, of course, there's also been some attention drawn to the Clippers recently on a bunch of different sites, particularly ESPN.com, about how Paul is the master flopper and Griffin is, like, his apprentice flopper. So I think there's a little bit more attention, especially with them falling apart the way they are.
So, okay, so is Kevin Love on the same stratosphere as far as being a star as Blake Griffin?
No.
Okay.
But you know that. I mean, Griffin's name, I mean, I would take Love over Griffin.
But you're saying star-wise, Blake is bigger.
Mm-hmm.
See, I do agree that part of, I think it has a couple more elements. I think part of it is Blake Griffin, but I think it's specifically that people have been saying for a long time that this is going to start to happen to Blake Griffin. I mean, earlier this year, Joel Anthony actually caught Griffin in the air, you know, and I think fouled him much harder. Blake got up. But, you know, people have been starting to, you know, have been saying since that Mozgov dunk, really, that if Blake keeps showboating and keeps dunking on people and keeps playing this way, you know, he's going to get hurt. So, I think that's part of it. I think that, you know, people in the media have always been expecting that this backlash from the players or some retaliation was going to happen. So I think, part of the story was already written. I think people already knew this was coming, and Jason Smith happened to be the face. And I think the other factor, as stupid as it is, you know, I was looking at the Twitter feed right after it happened, and I would say 9 out of 10 comments, without exaggerating, immediately after it happened, was some kind of Bounty Gate reference with, you know, the New Orleans Saints, who obviously,
yeah,
you know, right across the street is the arena, and all those issues that New Orleans happened. All I saw was, you know, did Greg Williams have put Jason Smith up to this? And, you know, just comment after comment. I think that honestly has something to do with it as well, even if it's just a small part.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't even think about that. You're right. I will say this. I just finished watching the game for the second time because my buddy came over and he's a big Paul fan, so he wanted to see the game. You could, knowing what happens, I could see it coming all game long, because Jason Smith was up for that game. I mean, he was throwing himself all over the place, and he was intentionally tripping. I saw him intentionally trip Griffin twice, and just grabbing and pulling and falling over and trying to drag him down. You could just see Jason Smith was working himself up all game to go after him. And like, it was only like two plays before where he put down that dunk and then walked staring at something in the crowd, and I couldn't tell if it was like a camera or some person in the crowd who'd been talking smack all game or something. So he was really worked up, so it doesn't surprise me at all that he just leveled Griffin on that play.
Yeah, and I think long-term what I really don't like about this is there's really nothing that Jason Smith could do moving forward to be anything but the dirty guy who took out Blake Griffin. You know, in the minds of people who aren't Hornets fans, don't watch Hornets games, you know, I doubt the casual fan of the Milwaukee Bucks had any clue who Jason Smith is. And now, you know, he's known by most fans around the league, but that's what he'll be known for. And it's a shame, because I mean, he was playing well in that game. He's really been playing well this season when he's been healthy. And, you know, I think it's a little bit of a shame that this is what he'll be known for moving forward. But honestly, my favorite part on that whole play was right after Jason Smith levels him.
VP or Blake?
What is Grievous Vasquez doing putting his arm up in the air? Basically, yeah. Said, you know, my foul. Because Jason had four fouls at the time, and, you know, Grievous was doing the nice thing as a teammate. But, like, did Grievous really think the refs were going to buy that?
Yeah, I noticed that tonight, and it is one of the funniest things. I don't even know what to say. I mean, he wasn't even close to – I mean, actually, if you watch it closely, Jason Smith pushes Grievous out of the way so he can hit Blake.
Yeah.
So, and then, of course, did you notice, though, that the very first thing – I mean, the first person on the in the fray, Chris Paul, was in Jason Smith's face pointing at him.
Yeah.
Do you like that or not?
Yeah, I think it's kind of Chris Paul's responsibility, and you know, I was actually over the All-Star break. It's so weird. I should go back and listen to it now. I mean, if you're watching old games, I should listen to old podcasts. But Bill Simmons is talking with Chris Paul over the All-Star break on a podcast, and Bill Simmons says, you know, point blank to Chris, "Hey, if he keeps dunking on people like this, he's going to get hurt. People aren't going to take it." And Chris says, "Yeah, but, you know, I'm his number one defender, and I'm always talking to refs and other players on the court." He's like, "Because I have those same exact worries." So I wasn't surprised about it, and I don't think it had anything to do about Jason, you know, with Jason Smith or the Hornets. But I, you know, and I actually think part of that two-game suspension was Jason Smith's immediate reaction, you know, afterwards, with him kind of, you know, waving his hands up to the crowd. But I just think at that point, you know, he's playing a tough game. Blake gets under a lot of people's skin. You know, it was a tough play, but I don't think there was anything premeditated about it. I think right. Jason Smith's running down court at what for him is full speed. And, you know, that's, I don't know. It was just interesting. I just hope, you know, it doesn't follow him forever. Maybe he'll be a seventh or eighth man on a champion one day, and at a parade he'll dance like Mark Madsen.
Right. Is this his Robert Horry moment when everybody turns against him?
Robert Horry, really? You really do pronounce everybody's names literally. H is silent. Take a Spanish class. But no. Okay.
Is he Spanish?
No, but it's Robert Horry. Everybody knows. But anyway, I mean, I found that game, so of course that's what we'll remember, but I found that game so incredibly interesting. The Clippers had 31 more field goal attempts than the Hornets. And it's not like, I mean, there was a free throw disparity, but it was only 10, which is the equivalent of 5 field goal attempts. So even if you give the Hornets those 5 field goal attempts, you're talking about 26 more field goal attempts. Just killed the Hornets on the offensive boards. You know, obviously that's part of it. Hornets kept turning the ball over. But I don't know if I've ever seen that big of a disparity as far as essentially points per shot. You know, I mean, when you really think about it, I mean, the Clippers averaged 1 point a shot. The Hornets were, you know, at over 1.5.
Right.
Is close. I mean, it was just such an odd game for the Hornets to win.
Yeah, and the strangest part about it is, I mean, there was that the collective IQ of the Clippers, just really, it's rock bottom. There were stretches where the Hornets were like up 4. And they were 2 minutes left, and they're taking desperation threes over. They're working the threes around the entire arc, getting offensive rebounds and trying for another desperation threes. And of course, it happens to be when Chris Paul's like momentarily on the bench. I don't think I've seen a dumber set of people playing basketball outside of the Wizards.
And I think a lot of people are you know, attributing this to Vinny Del Negro. And I guess I just want to get your opinion on this. We obviously watched a lot of Chris Paul. Started off the season MVP candidate, but honestly, as Hornets fans, we've seen this happen before with Paul, or at least Paul's teams kind of fade down the stretch. There's been talk of if Del Negro goes, there's kind of a short list of candidates. On that list would be one Mike D'Antoni. All we've ever seen is Paul run this kind of methodical, slow-paced offense. I mean, even this year with those super athletes, I think they're 26th or 27th in pace. What do you think, you know, Chris Paul would look like in an offense like that? And do you think he would even want to play in that kind of offense? Or do you think he likes this methodical, slow pace, and that's kind of where he fits?
Chris Paul is a half-court point guard, and I will never be convinced otherwise. I remember back when Byron Scott was the coach. It was probably the third season Paul was on the Hornets, and Byron was trying to like tell the team, we need to run, we need to run, we need to run. The team never ran. It never ran. Chris Paul never ran. And there was one very distinct game I remember where they were going against the Warriors. And ball went up and down the court really fast for about seven plays in a row. And Paul was wrecking the other team. He looked great at it. But they called a timeout, and Chris Paul walked over and slumped in the chair and looked like he'd been beaten. He was not used to that pace. It's not the way he plays. He's not a full court player. He can look good running a break, but he's a half court grinder.
But so just because of conditioning, though?
No, I don't even think it's because of conditioning. I just think he prefers to pick somebody apart and find their weaknesses, and I don't. He likes to have things set up. I think he's kind of a control freak, as you can see by the way he treats other players he plays with, where he's always telling them where to be and what to do and how to just. He likes to be set up so he knows exactly what's going to be happening and he can cut you apart. And in the open floor, that's all improv. And I don't think he's the best improv person in the world. This is a little bit of a dig, but even like his fancy dribble moves. I mean, Baron Davis could do crazy crap when he was on a fast break. Chris Paul's one move was like that fake, fake side dribble.
Yeah, the fake shimmy left comeback.
Right.
Yeah.
That was. I mean, he's a great ball handler, but he's not an improv specialist. Do you disagree?
To me, the best the Hornets ever played was in the second round in 2007-08 in that San Antonio Spurs series. And they just came out running in every second half at home and turned 4-point leads into 20-point leads in the third quarter. I mean, all three games, it seemed like, games 1, 2, and 5. And he was just so great in those situations. He had a trail guy, but I mean, it was when he had the teammates that fitted. He had a trail guy in West. He had spot-up shooters in Peja. And either Mo Pete or Gennaro, he had a run to the rim guy in Chandler. I really think it's dependent on the pieces around him, and I just don't think, you know, he's had those pieces. But part of me would absolutely love to see it because.
So you think he'd be special in that kind of situation? I mean, it would be awesome to see, but I would be flabbergasted if it worked.
I mean, yeah, I think, because when you think about it, I mean, Nash did it probably better than anybody ever has, but he still did it with high turnovers. I mean, imagine if Paul could bring his low turnover rate into that. And I don't know. It would be interesting, but I just feel like, I feel like after watching that game, I assumed that when the Hornets made the trade that Chris Paul was going to be a Clipper for at least the next 4, 5, 6, 7 years. After watching the Hornets win that game and just looking at, you know, the Clippers in general and where they are moving forward and you know, what they could possibly add, I don't know. I left that game wondering, how much longer he's going to be in L.A. and how the Clippers are going to rue the day that they gave up Al-Farouq Aminu for him.
Right. Well, yeah, because Aminu is going to be amazing in the future.
Yeah.
Based on this week alone.
Yeah.
I actually made the joke to my buddy after the game. I said, well, you know, in 2014, when the Hornets have Anthony Davis and one of the Zeller brothers, and they've got another draft pick from next year, and Eric Gordon's still on the team, that's going to look pretty good for Chris Paul to come home.
Yeah. No, I would take it. I don't care about collusion or any of that stuff. You know, I've often wondered, and I guess it's me, maybe I'm just kind of a deceptive, seedy person, but I've often wondered why we haven't seen a player in one of the sports do that. You know you don't have enough talent. You go to your GM and you say, look, I know you guys could get a lot of talent from me. You know, let's say I'm Dwight Howard this past year. I know you guys could get a lot of talent from me. I want to be in Orlando. Just trade me and I'll come back in the off season and we'll be stocked up. I don't know. I feel like there's so many things I would do kind of as a shady player that I haven't seen done yet. But, you know, that I watched the movie Celtic Pride and thought that was completely plausible, because I would seriously consider kidnapping somebody if it helped my team out. So that's just the kind of guy I am. Speaking of players in the future, the first game of the week was, Golden State and New Orleans. People were talking about the Warriors are going into tank mode after the trade. Klay Thompson, I guess I'll just add, I mean, we could look at his box score, but just actually watching him, what did you think? And when you think about some of the old proposals that were thrown around from Golden State for Chris Paul, is this a guy that you wish the Hornets would have ended up with?
So Klay Thompson was impressive in the game. When you look at, and again, you said this, we can look at his box score and you realize he wasn't actually as impressive as he came off. 27 points, but he did take 24 shots to get him. But the dude never stopped moving.
Right.
And he's a rookie. And you could very easily, in my mind, see him slotting into a Rip Hamilton role on a good team.
Right.
Where you're just running him off. Because that's what he did all game. He just ran off of picks and ran and ran and curled and made good decisions when he got the ball. And, yeah, I mean, Bellinelli's not the best defender in the world, so it's not a shock. But he was pretty impressive. And what we were talking about before, some sort of Klay Thompson, Epke Oda, I never know how to say that guy's name. Yeah, can you tell me how to say that name? Because, wow, it's screwed up.
Ekpe,
okay.
Udo.
All right. It's like Brett Favre. Anyways, Udo is actually a plus-minus star, too. So, sounds like a good trade to me. Would have been nice. I mean, even if it came with Andras Biedrins, who's completely useless.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I look at that Warriors team, and if they get a small forward or if Richard Jefferson, decides that he wants to play next year, and they're healthy, I mean, Klay Thompson, Steph Curry in the backcourt with, David Lee able to do his thing offensively and Andrew Bogut behind him, it's just a reoccurring theme with the West is there is really not a team that's that far away. I mean, to me, right. Sacramento is the only team that it would be really tough for me to see a scenario in which they make the playoffs next year or are a contender in the next couple of years just because of how the organization is run. But I could honestly see a scenario in which any Western Conference team is in the Western Conference Finals within the, at one point in the next 3 years.
Yeah, the only one I could not – only one I'd throw in there is Phoenix because, Nash has to go sometime, right?
I think he's staying. I really do.
Do you?
Yeah, I think he's a different breed. I don't think that he's going to go chasing titles. Or I know that's the new norm, but I think he stays, and I think it's more likely they add. But, yeah, I mean, that might be a little bit more of a stretch because of some of the bad decisions they made, but – I mean, you just look around. I don't even – if Houston doesn't make the playoffs, they're going to have three top 20 picks, it looks like. And Utah is going to have possibly two lottery picks or something in that area. Portland's going to have two lottery picks. I mean, it's just us, you know, as Hornets fans, we get excited about the future and what it could be. But there's a lot of teams that have, you know, some of the pieces already in place, plus the means to have a good future. So, yeah, the Klay Thompson coming on really, made me think. I know two of the guys the Hornets loved in this draft were Klay Thompson and Kenneth Fareyad, and that just makes me happy because I know if those are two guys they were trying to get up into the first round for, if they'll actually have picks this year, then theoretically they'll make the right choices.
Right.
So
no Andre Drummond for us.
Anything else stand out from that game? To me, what was interesting is in that game and then the next game against the Clippers, Xavier Henry was somewhat of a star. I mean, I think he hit the biggest shot of the game in the Clippers game. And
then, 3-pointer.
Yeah, and then he just did not show up in the final game against San Antonio this week.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know. Henry, when defended the right way, is nearly useless, honestly. And if any team of that set of three is going to defend you the right way, it's going to be San Antonio.
But it's just, I don't know, it's one of those situations that I don't know if you felt it, but every time you start to buy into a player, I guess they just can't sustain. I mean, even Gustavo had stretches. I mean, he came back and had a nice game or two this week, but even he's had stretches where, you know, you kind of start to curb your enthusiasm because, you just realize that these guys are probably just backups, if that. But, Henry's performance against San Antonio, I guess, I thought that stint with the Iowa Energy had really taken his game to the next level. And then
that one game. I mean, what do you think? I mean, do you like that they sent him out there for one game? Do you think it matters at all?
See, so when we had a little ESPN pickup game when I was down there for All-Star Weekend, and one of the guys I talked to was worked day in and day out in the D League, and he talked to me about the New Jersey Nets and how they've got their own D League franchise now and how great it's been working out for them, specifically because I think he said it's like a 1-hour commute from New Jersey to where their D League team is, and they do this, you know, or could theoretically do this all the time, where a guy could play in the D League game on Tuesday and then be called up maybe even Tuesday night, but definitely Wednesday by the Nets, and just get him plenty of game time. And, he said that he kind of thinks this is the future of the NBA D League relationship, but the problem is that other franchises just aren't that close. So I actually do like this theoretically, and I'd much rather, I think ideally if right in New Orleans or not far away, there was some kind of D-League affiliation, I think this would be a thing that I would, encourage the Hornets to do, more regularly. I honestly didn't mind it at all.
Yeah. I don't know how it's going to have much of an impact just to send him for one game. But, I mean, hey, if he's willing to go and he can get some extra minutes, this can't hurt, right?
Yeah.
Oh, I guess it can if he gets injured, but whatever. I'm not worried about that much. Dude's built like a tank.
Yeah. Another thing that I get, checked the Twitter feed quite recently and people are kind of talking about, wanted to get your opinion on this, is Chris Kaman and Carl Landry. So I think Kaman never said this, but quote unquote reports came out that Kaman was happy the Hornets kept him and didn't buy him out because he could essentially pad his stats going into free agency. Carl Landry came back the other night and almost killed the tank effort. So I guess people are kind of asking, why keep Kaman and Landry? We understand it's benefiting them because they're building up stats and getting more money, but they're probably not part of the Hornets' future. And if they are building those stats, it might come at the expense of the tank effort. I guess what are your overall thoughts on guys like Landry and Kamen still being around and still getting major minutes?
So, Kamen, I can understand the theory around that a lot more. I mean, again, I think I said before, I wanted to see him moved, and you made the point that, of course, we were asking for a first-round pick, and if your second option was a second-round pick was the cost to get him, you go with your second option if they're not so much worse than Chris Kamen. But having Chris Kamen on the team, owning his bird rights, being able to sign him to whatever you need to or sign and trade him, just gives the Hornets that much more ability, because if you think of it this way, say they traded Chris Kamen right now at the trade deadline, and he's no longer with the team. And Emeka Okafor, who is still, in my opinion, he's a better basketball player, but this summer they have the opportunity to, say, somehow combine Okafor with Xavier Henry or, you know, some other player and move him somewhere. Get that huge lodestone off the cap. Well, now you still have Kamen. If you had traded him, you don't have Kamen. You have no center options here at all. I mean, there's no way Goose is going to be able to play center. He's just too small. So, and the hardest, you know, spot in the world to fill is center. So it makes some sense to keep Kamen around. Giving a reason for Landry to still be here, I struggle, other than the fact that, and I forget where I saw this now, if you sign somebody who you own the rights to just a one-year deal, they have the right to refuse the trade.
A trade, right? But, I mean, why not work on a buyout or just not give him 29 minutes?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't really have a really great answer for you on that one.
Yeah. Yeah, and so I didn't have one either, so I asked a friend of mine, and you know, who works with another team that's in a severe, they're rebuilding right along with the Hornets. They're an Eastern Conference team, and he said that essentially what happens if you start doing that is you kind of you know, so let's say they did burn Kamen or burn Landry. You kind of start to earn this reputation around the league as a shady franchise. Guys don't want to play for you as much, yada, yada, yada. And his theory was that essentially the Hornets are conducting themselves like professionals and, you know, doing right by the players. And in the long run, you know, that'll help the team out a little bit more than getting Lance Thomas a couple extra minutes will. So I don't know. Is it interesting to me? I mean, I when I saw Landry was coming back, I thought maybe 15, 20 minutes, but you know, he got quite a few minutes there against San Antonio, and I just thankfully this team's schedule is good enough where I think even if everybody comes back healthy, to me there's absolutely no way that the Hornets aren't in the bottom three. It's just, are they going to be the second worst or third worst record when it's all said and done?
Right. So, I mean, if we're going to flip this over, I mean, there isn't a lot of benefit to playing Carl Landry for the Hornets. I mean, other than what you just said, you know, maybe it's a reputation thing. I mean, Carl Landry is a good player. His scoring ability sometimes makes the team more at risk to win, I guess that is how you say it, at risk to win. But what is a negative to playing him? Honestly, I mean, we're getting enough minutes for Ione. Lance Thomas, no one is going to snap up Lance Thomas over the summer and steal him away from us.
Like they did Patrick Ewing Jr.?
Exactly. I mean, no one's going to, like, you know, say, oh, Al-Farouq Aminu missed out on like 5 minutes a game, and if he'd had those extra 5 minutes a game, he would have turned into something.
Yeah.
I mean, there isn't, like, it's not really costing us too much either in development or in making us unable to retain the guys that we've got, because the one benefit that this team has with a lot of these guys is we're the ones who gave them their chance.
Right.
So they're going to be a lot more likely to be willing to stick around unless somebody bowls them over with an offer. And none of these guys are going to get a huge offer. Yeah. So, I mean, it's not necessarily hurting us to play him.
Not in,
I guess we could.
Not in this game, but remember, in this game, Okafor came in a reason Smith were out. Right. And those at least are three guys that you plan on bringing back. I guess I would just be interested to see with a full roster, is Landry taking away minutes from Smith or Ion or Aminu,
right.
You know, at the four position. So, yeah, I mean, that's, I guess the only other thing I got on this week was we kind of saw the Hornets were forced to play. First of all, I think perhaps the worst starting lineup I've ever seen in my life.
Against San Antonio?
A Marco Bellinelli, Lance Thomas, Gustavo Ayon front court. I've never seen a worse front court in my life. And then...
Come on, Belly got two rebounds in that game.
The back court was Vasquez and Jack, which, you know, two average players, but usually a team has, you know, at least one star in the back court. You know, or at least one quasi-level all-star type of player. But anyway, the Hornets go in with that lineup, and in a lot of ways, Jack was kind of playing off the ball. Just if Jared Jack is a starting shooting guard in this league, is he a – we both agree he's not a point guard, but would he be a top 20 shooting guard in a kind of weak shooting guard?
Yeah, I mean, if considering what other shooting guards there are in the league, yes, I think he would be. I mean, he wouldn't be, like, top 10, but, you know, seeing him slotted right around the 15 slot, I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, just, you don't want him as your close. It was just another...
Yeah, he's a terrible... He's just so bad as a closer.
Yeah, but, I mean, the Hornets aren't there without him, but, you know, of course, all people remember is the last couple minutes, but...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the discontinued dribble. I can't remember many times I saw that call.
Nope. Yeah, that was considering what the Hornets were running with, I was pretty happy with the results of that game.
Yeah.
I mean, it actually was perfect. Hornets were right there at the end and fell a little short. So... We're talking about stuff like this with Vasquez and Jack and, you know, maybe moving them around and, you know, this big glut of big men. But I guess you got a tweet question sent to you.
Yeah, it was an email, and now I feel a little guilty because I won't be able to give a shout-out to the person's name. I'll try to redeem myself in the future or put it in, but... But essentially, it was a rather long email, but it was well thought out. And, you know, he's just kind of asking me, I think his basic idea was, hey, look, the Hornets should go after a point guard with the Minnesota pick. If that's the case, you know, who are the Hornets going to want as the other point guard? I mean, you would have Jack, the veteran, you know, but perhaps a guy that might take away too many minutes or not be a long-term answer, or you have Vasquez, who would be another young guy, but a guy on a much cheaper contract, a guy you could keep around for a small number for a while. So it just got me thinking, and I really believe that for several reasons, 2013, the summer of 2013 and going into that 2013-14 season is just going to be, you know, a huge turning point for the Hornets, partly because that's when the new CBA rules kick in, and partly because it just seems like there's a lot of guys, you know, coming off the books or opportunities for the Hornets to get guys off the books. Then they'll obviously be an owner at that point. Eric Gordon could be going into free agency, yada, yada, yada. So we're playing a game called 2013, and I'm just going to throw two, sometimes three people at you. And I want you to tell me the guy most likely to be on the Hornets at the beginning of the 2013-14 season. And I'll give you, so you don't have to waste your time, I'll give you their current salary status and all that, so you have all that information. So we'll start right there with what the emailer sent me, and we'll go Jarrett Jack versus Grievous Vasquez. So Jack His contract will be up that summer. He'll have expired, you know, just before. He doesn't have, you know, any contract status with the Hornets going into the 2013-14 season. Meanwhile, Vasquez, the Hornets will have a team option for $2.15 million going into that season. So going into the 2013-14 season, who is more likely to be on this team, Jarrett Jack or Grievous Vasquez?
Jarrett Jack.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah, so I believe that Vasquez, I mean, you're going to have to take one of them, and I believe that the veteran leadership that Jack provides, the reasonable salary demands that he'll command, I believe that he will still be around, that Monty loves Jarrett Jack, that he will, they will try to do whatever they can to retain him. I think that Vasquez is exactly the sort of guy who could potentially tip a close trade in to be completed, where the other team is a little reluctant and you can say, how about I give you Vasquez?
And then it just completely turns them around.
No, but they're just like, yeah, well, I do have a small hole at backup point guard. He'd be nice there. And, you know, well, yeah, we can do that. Give me $3 million and I'll do it.
How about, I mean, I know that we might be a little jaded with expiring contracts. By the way, the emailer's name is Eric Ingus. And he is also trade certified, so he is legit.
Nice.
So next year, Jarrett Jack's on a contract expiring of about $5.6 million. You know, I don't think either one of us expect the Hornets to be contenders. Teams won't have to give back contracts, you know, as huge as what they would have had to given back for Kamen. And, you know, we saw Ramon Sessions get what essentially is 1.5 first-round picks from the Lakers. You know, teams always kind of need that veteran guy. Is there a situation in which, you know, Jack will be a wanted commodity at the trade deadline next year, and where I don't think Vasquez, either one of us, think that he'll actually be a guy you could get something real for? Is there any chance that that makes Jack less likely to be a Hornet than Vasquez?
No, and the reason why players like Sessions, the reason why they're available is because there are players that are better in front of them. I'm not convinced that in the first year, if we do get one of like those top point guards, whether it's Lillard or Marshall. Or is it Roten? Isn't that the other good
one?
Any of those three guys, I don't think any of them are going to be ready for showtime day one coming into the NBA. Maybe Marshall, but even then, I don't know if he's ready for the full load. So you're, of course you're going to giggle at that. So anyways, a full load of minutes.
Okay.
Does that sound better? So I don't see them willing to give up their veteran leader, their veteran point guard, at the trade deadline when they need him around for the guidance and for, you know, just keeping the team on the right keel. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong about that. I just have a feeling that Jack is like the current Willie Green from last year. And I just have a hard time seeing them being willing to let him go because they wanted to keep Willie.
Right.
So,
no, I mean, I would agree. So let's say, before we move on to the next one, let's say the Hornets do draft Marshall about halfway through his rookie season. It looks like he's ready to be a starting point guard in this league. You know, he takes over that. Jarrett Jack becomes a free agent in the summer of 2013. As the Hornets, what kind of offer? I think he'll be 30 at the time, about to be 31. What kind of offer would you I'm asking you to throw out offers, you know, 15 months from now.
Right.
What do you think would be reasonable?
2 years, $10 million total.
All right. So right about what he's making now. Interesting.
Yeah. I think he's reasonably priced. I think he's priced right about what he's worth. So, I mean, and I don't think his game is going to be crippled by, you know, aging when at age 30. So play him till age 32 for about the same price he's playing now. I think that sounds right.
All right. So the next one, we have two 2010 lottery picks. Both, again, the Hornets will have team options for. Xavier Henry will have a $3.2 million option the Hornets could exercise. Al-Farouq Aminu, about $3.8 million. And those numbers could change. The new CBA is weird where they give pay raises to rookie contracts if you started X number of games, decreases if you have whatever. But let's just go with those numbers. Starting off the year 2013, who do you got is more likely to be on the Hornets roster, Henry or Aminu?
Henry, because I don't believe Bellinelli will be around. That's the only reason. I think they're actually both equally liable to be moved for something. But if Bellinelli's not with the team next year, and, I mean, we have the question about Gordon, of course, I think Henry is more likely to be our backup shooting guard next year than Bellinelli is, which means Henry is more likely to stick around than Aminu.
Okay.
Disagree?
I think I agree with Henry, but more because I could see the Hornets drafting a small forward more than I could see them drafting a shooting guard this year. So, you know, I could see a situation in which the Hornets get the third pick and the best guy on their board is Michael Kidd-Gilchrist, taking him as the small forward of the future, and therefore Aminu being out of the plans, where I don't really see a situation in which the Hornets grab a stud shooting guard in this year's draft.
Not that high on Beal, huh?
I just think he's too similar to Gordon. You know what Beal has, and this has got to be a word, right? You know how they say that Kobe Bryant is ruthless?
Yeah.
Okay. Wouldn't somebody then be ruthful? Couldn't somebody be ruthful?
I have no idea what you're trying to say.
So if I'm ruthless, that means I'm absent of ruth, right?
Okay.
So, I mean, that's what. So wouldn't the opposite be that I'm just full of ruth?
I think it's being compassionate, my friend.
Well, I'm saying that he's too ruthful. He has no ruthlessness in him. There was several times, you know, when Florida just blew their lead to Louisville, that he just had no desire to take over late. I like his game. I think he'll be a nice, third guy on a good team in the NBA. I don't think that there's any situation in which the Hornets grab him. So, anyway, that's my the long rationale for why I think if I had to bet on one, I think Henry is here over Aminu. Just not because either player is going to stand out or really showcase that they could be a huge part of this team that Monty and Dell won't want to live without. It's simply because I could see the Hornets getting a small forward, you know, this right. summer, not a shooting guard. All right, so on to the next one. Kind of talked about this already. We got a guy who's a free agent this year in Chris Kaman versus a guy who will be set to earn a franchise high $14.6 million going into the 2013-14 season. If you had to bet, one of these guys is on the roster opening day 2013. Which one you got?
Okafor. I think that our front office's preference would be Kaman, but I don't think they're going to find anyone, especially with Okafor not playing right now, and his situation unknown with that left knee. I don't see them going to be able to find somebody to take Okafor off their hands this summer, which means that they're not going to be willing to pony up the money to keep Kaman and Okafor on the roster. So Kaman will probably walk, and will still. It's more likely that Okafor will be here longer term as a result.
See, I see it. I don't see many things in absolute, but I see a 0.00% chance that Emeka Okafor is on this team at the beginning of 2013, in that first day of 2013. If they can't move him, I don't care how cheap the next owner is, there's no way he's not getting amnestied. And when you amnesty a player, you obviously can't bring him back. You know, I think for the duration of the contract is the rule. So since I see that, you know, there's just absolutely no way that either next year or the year after Okafor won't be amnestied. I mean, it's got to happen. I see that as zero. And while I only see Chris Kamen, you know, being a long-term, you know, 3-4 year piece at 5 to 10%, 5 to 10 is still bigger than zero by my math. So I'd go Kamen actually.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Just
contract, ignore contract. Who would you rather have?
Kamen, because I feel like I could pair him. I've always felt that with Okafor, you're right, he might be the better player, but I feel like I would have to pair him with such a specific, when the Hornets first made the trade for Chris Paul, before there was talk about them flipping Pau Gasol, Pau Gasol is on my list of two or three guys that I think you could put next to Okafor and have a contending team. I think Pau Gasol and LaMarcus Aldridge are two guys that, you know, you could put next to Okafor and it could kind of hide some of his weaknesses. You could have a high post power forward who also has length, you know, could cover the center position theoretically. But I think there's so few guys that if I want to build a championship team that I could put next to Okafor and make it work. I think there's more people I could put next to Kamen. And, you know, so while Okafor might be better in a vacuum, I think Kamen is more versatile. I think he could just be a pure scorer off the bench, where there's not really many pure defenders off the bench. It's just not a role in the NBA. So I would take Kamen, and honestly, I think you could get Kamen and a guy like Omar Asik for less than you'll have to pay Okafor. All right, next one is Jay Smitty versus Gustavo Ayon. So contract situation, Jason Smith has a non-fully guaranteed $2.5 million going into 2013. I think the Hornets would only have to pay $500,000 and they could basically just let him go or give him the $2.5 to stay. And the Hornets also have a team option of $1.5 on Gustavo. So completely in the Hornets' court, whether they want to pay those guys this year. If I tell you only one is on the team in 2013, which one would you think it is?
Okay, my response, which is the cop-out, is I think both of them will be on the team. But since you're saying I have to pick one, it's Goose. I think Jason Smith is more tradable. If that makes sense. I think people will like what Gustavo brings, but I think Jason Smith, people will see him as, if you're trading with the Hornets, Jason Smith could be included in that trade, like theoretically he was put into the Lakers trade originally with Chris Paul.
Right.
And you could see him as a guy who could swing either center or power forward for you. And there's more people who are going to need an energy center than are going to need an energy power forward.
See, I was going to play devil's. I thought you would say Gustavo just based on skill, and I was going to go devil's advocate, but give the exact opposite point. I think trade value wise around the league right now, Gustavo's has got to be way higher. And when you consider the contract and the fact that this is first year in the NBA and he's already doing well, my thinking would be, okay, if the Hornets get Anthony Davis or Thomas Robinson, you know, in the draft or even Sellinger, whoever, there's just no way that Gustavo and Jason Smith are going to get the minutes unless, you know, I guess you play him as a small or soft center. And I just think that you could do something similar, you know, with Gustavo right now, not to the same level, but something similar with Gustavo right now as you did with Darren Collison. I mean, you have a guy who came in the first year in the league, kind of played above expectations, has a ridiculously small contract. I don't know. I don't know if there'll ever be a time where Gustavo's trade value is higher, especially, you know, if he flattens out and then, you know, the years on his deal get smaller and smaller. I really think this summer, if Demps is really shrewd, Gustavo, because of his play, other people thinking he has, you know, a higher ceiling than perhaps he really does, and his contract, I think this summer would be a really shrewd time to move Gustavo. And I wonder, you know, I wonder if they can move, let's say, him and the 11th pick for the 6th pick. I don't know. So I would actually say Jason Smith.
Okay. I don't know. I agree that Gustavo will probably be better regarded as a basketball player, but I still think that agile 7-footers, I mean, people trade all the time or acquire 7-footers all the time if they have any athletic ability whatsoever, and Goose doesn't have those extra 2 or 3 inches that he needs, which you should really let me let slide and not laugh at that.
No,
one.
That's all right. All right. Moving on. So this one is the last one, and it's actually a trois. I don't know. You just got me thinking about inches and full load, whatever. In my head. So this is the three way. And you could do it however you want. You could just give me the one guy, or you could rank them. But all of them have theoretically deals that would expire after next year. I give you Sir Eric Gordon. I give you Monty Williams. And I give you Dell Demps. One,
wow.
One of those is staying, I tell you. Who is that one guy that is definitely with the Hornets in 2013?
Monty Williams.
Really? So okay. So yeah. So why Monty over Dell Demps?
I think Monty Williams is well enough regarded in the NBA, and he did such a good job this year keeping a bad team and, you know, working hard. I think his reputation is such that whatever owner that comes in would be reluctant to get rid of that coach. However, I think an owner that comes in who's willing to keep that coach still wants to put his guy in the front office to be in charge of the team. So Dell Demps, I think, has a less secure position when a new owner is coming in. Now, of course, the new GM will probably want to put his own coach in there pretty soon. So, I mean, if that happens, Monty's not probably sticking around that long. But I think I've already told you, I think Eric Gordon, I don't think he's long for this team.
So Gordon would be left, and you're saying that, you know, Monty's more likely to stick around. Yeah, I think it's a real interesting situation. I mean, it's pretty funny. The Hornets have won one out of every four games. Their winning percentage is right around 25%. And I tweeted this the other day. I honestly think he's doing as good, if not a better job than 07-08 Byron Scott. I mean, okay, so I don't know if you have it right in front of you, but you know, you could look at it whenever you want. People listening to the podcast, go ahead and pull this up, you know, press pause, finish eating your bagel bite, and go look at the Hornets' schedule. If you look at the Hornets' schedule moving forward, I would bet pretty heavily right now as far as Vegas is concerned, there's only one game in which the Hornets might be favored moving forward. And that would be at home Wednesday, April 11th. Get your Sharpie out and circle it. Wednesday, April 11th at home against Sacramento. They will be underdogs in every other game. And I'll guarantee you that they'll win 5-7. If you win 500% more games than you're supposed to me, that's more impressive than the 07-08 Hornets, who beat who they were supposed to beat and then, you know, won the occasional game at San Antonio.
Absolutely. I mean, and here's the whole, you take this team, this roster, and you start the intended starting lineup for this year, where you have Jack, Gordon, Ariza, I guess Landry was the intended power forward, and Okafor. You got those five guys, and you look around the league. they're still only more talented than like three or four teams. They're not tremendously talented crew, and we've been missing half of that squad for most of the season.
Right. Yeah, Gordon would be the only above average starter in that group.
Right.
He would be the only guy that would rank in the top 15 at his position.
So, I mean, it's and I mean, do you even look at the bench guys? I mean, they're nice bench guys, but you, I mean, if you took a poll of the supposed our bench crew should be, and compared them against all the other bench crews in the league, yeah, they might be in the top half, maybe.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think he's doing a great job. I think it would be a shame if he left. It's just we're really not going to know until this ownership situation gets settled. But to me, you know, if I could kind of give anybody, player, coach, GM, whatever, a contract right now on the spot, I think the top two got, you know, a 5-6 year contract extension. The top two I would want would be Monty and Dell. And then, you know, after that, I feel okay about you know, Eric Gordon. But really, to me, I just really hope those two are long for the franchise. I think, you know, they've done a great job in a horrible situation. I just wonder if they're so jaded by their experience, you know, that it actually goes the other way. I mean, does Monty Williams look at the Portland situation and want to go back and be the head coach? Or, you know, does he get lured by other teams that, you know, kind of haven't put him through what this organization has gone through? So anyway, interesting.
Well, it is possible within this week or the next that we'll have Dell Demps on a special podcast, and you can let him know that you think he's that valuable to
the team. Oh, I will. I will every day.
You could suck up to him every way possible.
No, it's just good to have a competent guy. But all right, so that's the year 2013. But before we get there, we've got to have a draft in 2012. I know a lot of you know, Hornets fans have actually come right out and said, "Hey, I don't watch much college basketball, but I've been watching because I know that, you know, at least one, if not two of these guys are going to be Hornets next year. I want to know more about them." Personally, in my power rankings, the top four guys have all made it to the Final Four. I mean, for those of you not reading the pieces every Saturday, Anthony Davis and Michael Kidd-Gilchrist, both from Kentucky, in the Final Four in New Orleans, coincidentally. Thomas Robinson, who had another amazing game today over North Carolina, is in the Final Four, my number two overall player. And Jared Sullinger coming in at number four, number one in Ryan's hearts, his Ohio State
hearts.
Team. Yeah, you have multiple hearts.
I'm an alien.
You do. So he's coming in. But so anyway, I talked to a friend of mine, read the article, and he told me that two guys are much lower on the scouts list that he talks to than were on my list. Bradley Beal, just because they feel that other shooting guards have more length and size for the NBA game. So, you know, that's one thing I could understand that. But he said Jared Sullinger is a lot lower. And then the reason he gave me was interesting. I haven't told you this yet. Just want to see what you think. So he said that when Jared Sullinger has been measured, that he has a significant difference between the size, between the length of his two legs. One is almost, he said it was significant enough that orthotics could not help it. So he's talking about close to like the 2-2.25 inch range of difference, like a massive difference. And he said that, you know, this didn't used to scare teams.
But, Oden?
Huh?
Greg Oden?
Greg Oden has the longest, you know, measured difference in between his two legs. And a lot of theories are that this is why Oden has been hurt, will be hurt, continue, whatever. And because of Greg Oden and that anomaly, and now Jared Sullinger having something similar, teams are being scared off and they think that Sullinger will always have back or leg or foot problems and it'll be a continuing thing based on that. Your initial reaction?
I've never heard anything that sort. I mean, I'd heard them people saying that about Greg Oden, but I never realized they were actually blaming that for all of his issues. If Sullinger falls because of that, it's crazy. I'm sorry. I mean, he's not even reliant on his athleticism for most of his except he uses his really large butt to get himself room, and then he's got a lot of touch around the basket. I mean, he doesn't even jump high.
But he has to be on the court to do that. On the court.
Nothing could make me happier than the idea of Jared Sullinger somehow slipping to the Hornets' second pick.
Right.
I mean, honestly, we can talk about this. I'm just kind of flabbergasted. That's the reason why Jared Sullinger might be. I thought it might be something like his personality was a problem because they had issues in Ohio State this year. Because his leg is too long?
I was surprised too, but it's legitimate. It's legitimate as far as the reason that scouts are afraid. But okay, so that doesn't worry you at all. I mean, in retrospect, if you had the 18th pick in the draft, would you have drafted Greg Oden? I mean, does it really matter how far he falls? If it's whether or not this is going to be a legit issue, it's not. You know, there's not a value where he wouldn't be worth it at 4, but he would be worth it at 11. I mean, if this is
they also said that what's his name down in San Antonio wasn't going to be able to play at all.
Yeah, but
because he had no ACL.
But there was no precedent for that. Now there's a precedent, so if another non-ACL freak came out, I don't think that would deter teams, but I think the worry here is that there has been a precedent set and that you know, Sullinger is going to have to unset it in some ways or prove that it was some other reason for Oden. But yeah, so just it's something interesting to watch. And yeah, it's true. I mean, the Hornets, you know, Minnesota did us a disservice again by winning today against Denver, but their schedule remains pretty hard. They look like with Utah surging and other teams playing well, there's no way they'll make the playoffs. So the pick will still finish somewhere between 10 and 13. But yeah, a Michael Kidd-Gilchrist, Jared Sullinger combo is looking like at least like it could become a possibility.
Yeah. So, I mean, let's just throw out Anthony Davis, because I know that, you know, you would trade anything on this team for a chance at Anthony Davis. If you could pick any pair of players, and I know we're probably picking like 3rd and 11th,
right,
but just ignore that. And I think you're going to say Robinson and Gilchrist because they're the top two, but what two guys would you want? Like, what pair in this entire draft would you want to put together looking towards the future if Anthony Davis was out of the picture?
Michael Kidd-Gilchrist would definitely be one of the two. I think it's a culture thing. I mean, to me, I don't see anybody outside of Davis being, you know, the guy that you're going to in game 7 of a playoff series or a guy that transforms your team. I think Michael Kidd-Gilchrist transforms the locker room. He transforms the culture. He becomes the coach on the court. I mean, of course he has all the skills as well, but I would always bet on that, you know, kind of the intangibles. So Gilchrist would definitely be one. And then I guess, so I got a slasher score. I mean, I really wish that there was a point guard that, you know, that really had no flaws in his game to pair with them. But I guess Robinson would be the safe pick, but I guess I'll go out on a limb here, and if I'm going to have that guy who's a hard worker, who's a team leader, then what I'm going to do is grab the guy with the biggest upside and make Gilchrist's job to motivate this guy night in and night out. So I'm going to take Michael Kidd-Gilchrist and Andre Drummond.
Wow.
And I'm going to make Michael Kidd-Gilchrist get inside of him every practice. And and just absolutely make sure that Drummond reaches all of his potential. Because Thomas Robinson reaching all his potential, I think the other day I put Carlos Boozer with Hart as his ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if people remember how good this guy was in his prime, but when I started thinking about it more, I would probably change that to Sharif Abdur-Rahim. Mm-hmm. And Rahim was a 2010 guy, 2011 guy, like really good player, but I think he's one of those infamous guys who never won a playoff series. You know, was the right. really good player, the number one guy on a 40-win team, or the number two guy on, you know, a 46-win team. So that's Andre Drummond's ceiling is, you know, just below Anthony Davis's. So those would be my two. I would think that, you know, hopefully Kid Gilchrist's, you know, passion would rub off on Drummond. I'm guessing you had a thought in mind.
Yeah, I got a pair here. And you're going to laugh at me about one of them. But I would take Thomas Robinson, and I'd want to pair him with Cody Zeller.
Oh, God.
Because I'm looking to try to fill my front court with guys who I think have a hell of a lot of potential. And I think Robinson gives you all the energy, all of the heart, all of the mid-range ability. And I think Cody Zeller, just watching him, I think he has the ability to be a very nice Rick Smits. That's kind of lame to do Rick Smits because he's white. Let's see. I mean, he's got a decent, I guess, Lopez up in New Jersey. I think of him as having that
just
sort of game.
Just a semi-white guy. Way to go out on a...
Well, no, but I'm trying to think of like more of an offensive-minded center who's maybe not a rebounding master or even a defensive master, but he'll be able to get you buckets.
I said his ceiling was Nene.
Zeller?
Yeah. The young,
said Greg
younger,
Monroe.
Younger Zeller. Oh, Cody. Yeah, okay.
Not Tyler. I'm thinking
Cody.
Oh,
okay, Cody. Yeah. So, yeah, Greg Monroe.
There's just something there. I think that he could be it'd be a really nice combination of the energy guy and the big man who can score for you.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I don't know how many times we have to kind of go through these bigs that don't translate. I'm just a little worried about it. I mean, you see the guys, I don't know. It's a process in which feel like we have such a good handle on, and then, you know, Isaiah Thomas, who was the last pick in the second round, is a legitimate right. first team all rookie candidate now.
Yep.
It's just, you know, but you know, guys like that'll even out. I guess what's not fair is how early we judge these guys. And, you know, I think it's a hard process. And what's really interesting to me is if you kind of look at the guys the Hornets will be looking at, you're talking about a lot of, I mean, most of them are 19 years old. So that means when their rookie contract is up, they're not even in their basketball primes yet, or they're just entering them. And then you have to make this decision on who they are as a player and how much they're worth. I really think that's tough. And it's just, you start to think, okay, well, then I want the guy who in 2 or 3 years is already a star, and I don't have to wonder about what they're going to become. And it seems like most of the guys like that are guards. It seems like, you know, you think about Derrick Rose, Russell Westbrook. I mean, I know.
Yeah, you get Griffin and Durant.
I'll say perimeter players. Just guys right. who have the ball in their hand a lot, and then, you know, they just kind of are given a lot of chances to fail. And through that, they come through on the other side.
So I knew we were going to talk about the draft here. Let me ask you one other question. I'm suspicious it's going to be Drummond because, you know, that's an easy one. Let's throw Drummond out of this question. Out of your, like, top 14, which of these guys is the hardest for you to figure out what he's going to turn into in the NBA?
Damian Lillard.
Damn. That's exactly what that guy, his numbers are un. Friggin' believable.
Have you seen them against real teams, though?
Right.
I think I put it. Yeah, I mean, so he played two teams that were actually in the tournament, and these weren't even great teams. This was BYU, who was a 14 seed. They played in the play-in game, and Cal, who was a 12 seed, who also played in the playoff game. So these are, you know, theoretically the 66th and 67th teams into the tournament. Those are the only two real teams that he played, and against those teams, he averaged 14.5 points and shot 34%. Against all the other garbage mid-major teams that don't have a player that'll make the pros, he averaged 25 points on 47.5. So I think if I didn't want the Hornets to have a point guard so bad, that I would dismiss Lillard right away. But I think for some reason I haven't. But I don't.
Yeah, I mean, when I was looking at your thing and you said Russell Westbrook's the top end and Felton was the bottom end, I thought you were being generous on the bottom.
Well, okay, I meant this year's Raymond Felton.
Okay, well then you're right on because he's been terrible this year. Because I mean, I have no idea what to expect from him at all. And I mean, this includes a list that has, you know, Perry Jones III, who has had one of the worst falls from grace I've ever seen in the draft, where he came in at, you know, like the number two guy or the number three guy on a lot of boards. And if he's picked in the lottery, I mean, it's going to be purely still on maybe he'll figure it out.
Yeah, I mean, there's been more. DeAndre Jordan was a lottery pick. I don't even remember him being top eight pick.
But I have never seen a guy who's like thought of as a potential second pick in the draft falling to the point where people are like, I mean, just cringing at the mere thought of drafting.
And I do this with my wife from time to time, where I'll just put on a game. And I mean, she watches a lot of NBA basketball, not as much college. And I'll just put on a game and I'll say, okay, there's two pro prospects in this game. You watch and you tell me which one it is. If you put on a Baylor game with any fan, casual, serious, whatever, and you say, you tell me, you know, which of these guys is a potential lottery pick, or, you know, what, they would never get to Perry Jones.
Right. It's that Miller guy before him.
Quincy Acey is by far, you know, the leader, the kind of heart of that team. They have a guard on that team who, you know, is the one who makes things happen. And then, yeah, Quincy Miller just seems more talented. So yeah, the Perry Jones thing is really interesting to me, and he's going to go, you know, in the lottery, but you know, everything tells you to take, I think old school scouts take Perry Jones over Tyler Zeller. I think if this was 5 years ago, before we really talking about more advanced metrics, and I think Perry Jones would go over Tyler Zeller 100 out of 100 times. I'm really interested to see this year which one of those two guys specifically go first.
Yeah, the only other comment I had about the draft as it stands right now, McAdoo is flying up the charts and some things landing in the top eight. Has no one learned from Marvin Williams and Brandon Wright and these guys who are, you know, UNC ultra-athletic power forwards who have proven nothing?
See, to me, that
make them prove
something.
See,
I was thinking about that same thing, and I think that's unfair. I think I saw somebody on our site compare Marvin Williams to Harrison Barnes. And they would have never made that comparison if Harrison Barnes went to St. John's. I think it's such a ridiculous thing to associate guys with the school.
Okay. Like, it doesn't matter that it's UNC, but really, that's what he is. He's proven nothing.
I understand, but, and this is going to sound like a weird thing to say, I think NBA players move, successful NBA players just move a certain way. Like, there's a fluidness to the, it's so, I mean, I remember when I was young, I could tell whether a kid was good or not just by watching him pass.
Have you ever seen Larry Bird?
You're Larry Bird. he didn't move well because he had 8 herniated discs at the end of his career. But I'm telling you, there's a fluidity, and you can't watch North Carolina games anymore. Maybe you have this last one TVOD. Wow. TVOD.
Yes.
Watch McAdoo, just not while he's has the ball, just running. He is an NBA. I will bet any amount of money that he is a better NBA player than John Henson. And see, I would normally agree with you, but just that's all I did today was watch McAdoo without the ball, and he moves like an NBA player. So I actually wouldn't mind if the Hornets took him with the Minnesota pick if he does decide to come out. I would take Perry Jones if he. I didn't assume he would come out, but if he did, I would put him at number 12 in my rankings right now, right behind Jeremy Lamb and right in front of Damian Lillard. I would take him over Terrence Jones, who has done plenty in college right now. So I actually disagree. I agree with your overall point. I disagree on McAdoo. Sorry.
Okay.
So that's it. That's our draft talk. Expect us to be talking about that and just that after this painful season comes to an end. But it is not over yet. The Hornets have 5 games in 7 nights this week, starting tomorrow. All road games at that. I guess looking at the schedule, anything stand out to you? I mean, is it the Clippers game at LA, or are we talking about
Yeah, I really wish that Jason Smith would be in that game just so you could have that little added tension going on there. But I don't know. The team that of all the ones I want to talk most about is probably Portland, which is a Thursday game, middle of that 5-game and 7-night stretch. Portland used to be the team I was like the most nervous about. I mean, when the Hornets were having like their little surge and becoming the team that was relevant in the West and the young team that people might need to, you know, fear, Portland was doing the same thing. And in my opinion, at the time, they were doing it a little better than the Hornets, with, you know, Roy, and they had Oden on board and Aldridge, and they were just doing that really well.
Yeah, they had size, which the Hornets know.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, so I always was like a little like, you know, Portland is the team that I always like was more angry about. And when Tyson Chandler would get into it with Prisvilla, I was always like really happy about that. Portland is once again set up to be in the exact same situation as the Hornets. They're blowing things up. They've got one piece in place. I guess you could call Batum another piece. But like you said before, they're like a step ahead of the Hornets because they're blowing it up, getting a whole bunch of really important, those secondary picks in the lottery, and they've already got, I guess you saw Wes Matthews, Batum, and LaMarcus Aldridge in place. I have a feeling that once again the Hornets will be clawing and scratching with Portland in the years to come. So again, looking towards the future, Portland I think is a pretty interesting team to look at.
Yeah, and I mean I remember I said this after. I was so mad with that Nets trade, and you said, you know, well, they don't have a GM or really competent owner, and that's kind of, you know, something to fall back on where, you know, maybe that messes them up. Although their acting GM, I just listened to a podcast with him on with our godfather, Henry Abbott, today, and he seems like a very realistic, intelligent guy. So that didn't make me too happy. But, yeah, I guess the only solace in the the Trailblazers situation is there's almost no chance they get a top 3 pick this year, where obviously we've discussed and there's going to be good players to get at, 7 and 12, wherever they end up. But they'll also be busts in that range, where I don't think there'll be any busts in the top 3 this year. So, if the Hornets get, I guess to me, if the Hornets get Anthony Davis, I couldn't care less what the Trailblazers do with picks 7 and 12. But, yeah, you're right. If the Hornets get 3 and 12 and the Blazers have 4 and 11, plus everything right. They already have, it'll kind of be scary.
If the Blazers manage to snag themselves some sort of combination of, like, say, Kidd Gilchrist and Beal or even, like, Barnes, I mean, maybe that's not the most likely situation, but it would not take much to turn that team around.
Yeah.
and make it a force again.
And again, they could also go the other route. I mean, they could have the power to say, okay, we got Aldridge and Batum, you know, let's trade the fifth pick for Rajon Rondo and go the veteran route. Yeah, I mean, it's
That's a sick thought.
Yeah, so yeah, it'll be be interesting moving forward, and that's why every night I just rack my brain of who to root for, cuz before it was rooting against the Timberwolves. But now I'm rooting for New Jersey, and I'm rooting for them to pass teams like Toronto and Detroit. So I don't want Toronto and Detroit to win too much, but I want them to win enough to stay ahead of the Hornets, but not enough to, you know, to where New Jersey can't pass them. And then I'm rooting for Houston to make the playoffs, I think. Why am I rooting for that? Oh, yeah, because then New Jersey gets their pick. And then I'm rooting for the Knicks to make the playoffs, so it's a worse pick for Houston. And it's getting so mind-boggling, I can't even handle it. Like right now, Golden State is playing Portland as we talk. I really don't know who to root for, because I want the Warriors pick to be bad enough to where Utah doesn't get it, because Utah is another up-and-coming team. But then, for the reasons we already stated, I want the Trailblazers to keep winning. Like, I'm just stressed out every night and not enjoying the NBA at all, because I can't even keep track of who to root for. Phoenix beat Cleveland today. I think that's good, but I'm sure somebody's going to write in with some reason why that hurts the Hornets. So,
right.
I don't know.
Yeah, so, I mean, I actually was kind of following along the same way you are. I have three teams that I root against. Minnesota, of course. The Clippers, just because I'm petty. And New Orleans, because I want them to have a bad record.
Yeah. But you know it's really going to suck when, on the final night, the Hornets jump Washington for the second worst record, and then Washington gets the number one pick. Like,
just stop.
No matter how we play it, you know, whoever gets the number one pick, we're going to say, oh, if the Hornets would have just won these three games, they would have got that. I mean, really, unless Charlotte gets the number one pick, we're going to be able to play that game and just torture ourselves afterwards. Right. So, yeah.
Well, just got to keep remembering, the Hornets have an 80% chance that they won't get the first pick, at least an 80% chance, right? So we do this 4 out of 5 times. We've only gotten once. Just got to remember that, because, I mean, I keep looking at Anthony Davis and...
I know. I
that unibrow, man.
Yeah. I want him so bad. Yeah. Honestly, somebody said during the Clippers game, would you take Anthony Davis or Blake Griffin right now if you could have one? And I thought about it, and I came up with my entire list of, if I, you know, had a franchise right now, if I was the Hornets right now and I could have anybody, my list was LeBron 1, Durant 2, Anthony Davis 3.
Wow.
I would rather have Anthony Davis right now moving forward than Dwight Howard. The only other guy who almost was on that list ahead of Anthony Davis was Derrick Rose, and I don't know why this isn't more of a story, but I've seen these back issues with Tracy McGrady and Baron Dave, and like, They don't just go away where you never hear about them again. And if he loses that explosive, so Anthony Davis is number 3 on my list of, I could have absolutely anybody in the world. He's my 3rd. And, yeah,
wow.
I want him.
I think I'd take Blake Griffin. I'm sorry.
Over Anthony Davis.
Yeah.
You understand you played 2 sides of the court, right?
Yeah, I know. And I'd probably take Kevin Love over Anthony Davis.
No way.
I've gotta. I mean, those guys are proven commodities. And although I fully expect Anthony Davis to be dominant on one side, I don't expect him to necessarily be dominant.
Okay, but what's more likely? So I grant you, Love is dominant on offense. Davis is dominant on defense. But what is more likely, that Anthony Davis becomes dominant on offense, which we've seen players evolve, or that Kevin Love magically becomes a dominant defensive player? I've never seen that in the history of the NBA.
And I haven't either, but it is much easier to fill in a second big man who can play defense than it is to fill in a second big man who can play offense.
And I'm saying you won't have to. I mean,
I understand. Do you think that he's going to become like the next, you know, Hakeem Olajuwon?
I think he is much farther along offensive, much farther along now offensively at 19 than Hakeem, Patrick Ewing, any of the. I think offensively he could become David Robinson, defensively become Kevin Garnett, Hakeem Olajuwon.
Wow. Wow, talk about expectations. And, I mean, honestly, I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just saying I still take a proven commodity right now in certain situations than over Anthony Davis. But, yeah, I mean, your list is three people long, and mine is probably like seven.
Right, but somebody has to be that person. I mean, in 1983, I'm sure, you know, Bernard King was – I don't know. I'm probably getting my history wrong. Or, you know, whenever Jordan came out, I'm trying to think who was like a high scorer. I mean, eventually there's going to be the next great player. And to me, it's clear as day that Anthony Davis is him.
Well, I believe then it was Drexler was the perfect example you're looking for.
But he was
Trailblazers passed on him for Drexler.
Well, yeah, but I mean, he was still young. I'm trying to think of a guy who was like in his fifth or sixth season, a Mochi. Julius Irving, whatever. If you would have said that this guy, Jordan, I'll take him over Julius Irving right now, people would have thought you were insane. So I understand people think I'm insane, but I'm not. This week, yeah, I mean, so many games to pick from. Portland was one I was interested in as well. But, you know, the Lakers game is interesting to me. They're playing so well at home. And, you know, just remembering that game from last time, like the Hornets had it won, and honestly, the Lakers should be able to destroy the Hornets every time, but it just seems to me that Kobe is not willing to go inside to Bynum and Gasol, and he basically does a great job of defending those guys. I think it's a crazy game that the Hornets could steal, because the Lakers are on national television tonight. They're on NBA TV Tuesday, and then another nationally televised game with the Oklahoma City Thunder on Thursday. They'll be coming off of those three nationally televised games, perhaps even a win at home against Oklahoma City, in which everybody's excited. And now they got a Saturday afternoon game with the worst team in the Western Conference. To me, if there's a game where the Lakers fall asleep and the Hornets could steal something, that's that one. So I just like that possibility as the steal game of the week.
I think the most likely steal game of the week is in Golden State Wednesday, just because I don't respect Golden State. I want to say Phoenix, but I think Phoenix is playing pretty well right now, and that is the very last game of this really long stretch of games, so I can't pick that. Honestly, I'm going to make the call here. Hornets aren't winning a game in this stretch of five. It's their 0-5.
They're 0-5. I'm going to take 1-4, and they're winning that. They're winning that Lakers game.
Okay.
They're winning that Lakers game, and but seriously, Hornets fans, look at the schedule. This five is brutal. It doesn't get much better. I see that some of them are, you know, most of them are at home. They got, you know, one game against the Eastern Conference, and thankfully is against Charlotte, but it's at Charlotte. I really think that Sacramento game is the only game where they're favored the rest of the year, and I don't even know if they're favored in that game. I think it depends how Sacramento's playing at that time and how bad some of these Hornets losses have been. But by the way, what's going on with Denver? Do you remember earlier in this year Portland and Denver being talked about as the two best teams in the West and two teams?
Yeah, they're falling apart.
Not even going to make the playoffs. Interesting.
Yeah, and I mean, that Carmelo Anthony trade's looking, you know, better for New York all the time.
I don't know. I don't. Is there a trade that both teams could lose? Yeah, but
well, if there is one, Carmella would be part of it.
Takes down both ships. all right, well, interesting. I've enjoyed this one. Yep. And I'm going to go measure my legs right now. Because right. I haven't
see if you can expect back injuries for the
I
rest
have.
Of your life.
I felt a little twinge. I didn't know whether it's a new mattress that I'm breaking in or it might just be the length of legs. So I suggest we all go out and get that done now.
All right. And thanks, everyone, for listening to In the Know. And we'll be back next week and maybe a little earlier if we can manage to land our special guest. It's a party town, ain't nothing but a party. Down by New Orleans, a land of redskins, slot machine, voodoo queen, voodoo queen.
Nobody builds 5G like Verizon builds 5G. Because we're the engineers who built the most reliable network in America. And the more you do with 5G, the more building it right matters. The more your network matters. The more Verizon engineers going the extra mile matters. It's us pushing us. It's Verizon versus Verizon. 5G built right from America's most reliable network. Most reliable based on rankings from RootMetrics second half 2020 U.S. report of 3 mobile networks. Results may vary. Award is not an endorsement.